This is Taking Aim with
Roshan Men
and Maya Schoen.
On the evening of July 6th at Judson Memorial Church in New York City, friends, admirers, and supporters of Lynn Stewart gather together to express their support for an extraordinary woman, a gifted lawyer, and a woman convicted for her political affiliations. Show your love. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Thank you for coming. We all know why we're here. It's for Lynn Stewart, to cheer her on, to cheer ourselves on, and to be ready for the big day.
It's now an honor to bring to the mic Lynn Stewart's co-counsel in the defense of Sheikh Rahman, the very well-known and courageous attorney Ramsey Clark, so often described as former attorney general. He thinks it's his middle name now, but is known around the world for his courageous stands in struggles against war, against racism, against injustice. We want to salute Ramsey Clark's continued determination and welcome his testimony.
Lynn got in this trouble through me. It was July of 94, and we were desperately looking for a lead trial counsel for the Sheikh. And Lynn and Ralph came up to the office, and for about an hour I described the case, set for trial in September. 12 defendants, one of whom proved to be an informer and one of whom pled guilty, so the number was reduced. Thousands of hours of wiretaps that had to be gone over and documents that had to be gone through, and a near impossibility, but also the importance of the case as I perceived it. And at the end, I'll see whether Ralph remembers as I do. He stood up, and out of love, he said, "Lynn, don't do it." Remember that?
I remember.
I mean, he meant it, too. And he had good reasons. But Lynn was Mother Courage personified. Lynn's courage compelled her to do it. And she knew the stakes, not only for the people directly involved in the case, but for the growing war on Islam, which some call the war on terrorism. And she plunged in. The case went on for 9 months with Lynn brilliantly fighting it every inch of the way. The trial was hopelessly unfair. The jury selection itself, done by the judge, and so limited. The blind Sheikh had his picture in the paper every day. And this is before we knew about Osama bin Laden. He was number one in these days. Of course, he was totally nonviolent. By the time he was 15 or 16, he became what they call him Hafez. He had memorized the entire Quran. Very, very few people ever do that. He went on to Al-Azhar University, which is the greatest Islamic university, certainly in Egypt and probably in the world. It's over 1,000 years old. He was tried in Egypt for involvement in the murder of Anwar Sadat before a political military tribunal. I'd had a couple of cases before that tribunal, and the facts didn't matter. But the country is Muslim. And they didn't have the guts to convict him because they knew that every Muslim would understand that Islamic scholars and imams don't give orders. They don't tell you what to do. They read the Quran. They tell you what the Quran guides us to do in our lives. And he was acquitted twice. We've just learned this year, at least I have, and I don't think it was known publicly, he wasn't in the investigation. I mean, an FBI agent investigating a bunch of guys who are planning and mixing up explosives and stuff like that, didn't go off to a mosque 30 miles away and talk and see whether a blind sheikh is involved in it. But the way it happened, and this comes from Mary Jo White, who was the United States attorney in charge of the office at the time. She said, as of Andrew McCarthy, who was the chief prosecutor, as to why the sheikh was included, he did it, plain and simple, that's the answer. And he did it on an unbelievable ground by seeking to expand counts for what people did to a sedition count. The lead count was a sedition count. It's not facts, it's belief. You remember the alien sedition laws and all the rest. We've never really believed in sedition. And they had to drive to Washington to get permission. This is after the case is developed. So he was added right at the end. But then all of a sudden, he's the first defendant. And he's the, and some of the guys didn't even know him. Some of them went to his mosques. Some of them really loved him. He knew some of them. But he took no action. He couldn't take action. How could a blind man that couldn't speak English and couldn't see and didn't know these United States or anything else make any difference? We got through the trial, and there was heartbreak, and we all realized that we had a duty as lawyers to continue to help the sheikh. He had two life sentences. He had diabetes. I mean, he was in the hospital during the trial part of the time. And it was terrible. I mean, open sores between his toes and things like that. Hard life. He paid no attention to it. His spirits were always good. He loved Lynn more than anybody. They would meet and talk for hours. He had total confidence in her. He had insisted on trying himself, his own case. He couldn't do it. I mean, he doesn't speak the language. He doesn't know the country. He doesn't know the customs. He doesn't know the law. It'd be impossible, as brilliant as he is. But he stood by Lynn. I don't know if there's another lawyer in the country that he would have stood by. The sheikh wanted to do his own defense. He wouldn't have done it except for Lynn. I personally believe that the Sams are an abomination. It's like an oath. I always refuse to take an oath. If you don't trust me, that's your right. But don't expect me to work with you. And the Sams are like an oath where you say, I won't do this, I won't do that. We signed them with great reluctance, but we couldn't abandon the sheikh. Lynn gave up all of her practice, really, for 9 months, all of her clients, making practically no money. I don't think we could scrape up $3,000 a month for expenses and everything else for them. And after that, our effort was to keep the sheikh's name before the public. He's an international figure. Because if he gets lost in American prisons and isn't known, there'll be no pressure any place in the world to get him out. And also to begin work immediately to try to get him transferred to any Arab prison. See, his isolation is total. You can be in solitary confinement, as many people are, but he can't read because he can't see. He can't read Braille anymore because his physical condition has reduced the sensitivity in his fingers. He can't read Braille. He can't understand English. They won't let him associate with any other prisoners. It's total isolation. He can't watch TV. Can't see it. So there he is, and we had to try to work as best we could. I don't know that Lynn did anything I didn't do or some of the others didn't do. We're all working as hard as we could to keep his image alive and his life alive. And I went to Egypt a number of times and thought I was making some progress. Went to a couple of other Arab countries and got offers, but the U.S. wouldn't agree. Lynn's indictment should not have happened. And now the government wants 15 to 30 years. They filed a 150-page resentencing memorandum. I don't think I've ever seen a 15-page one before, and I've been watching these things for a long, long time. I mean, you just don't do that. And they don't say a thing that it makes any sense. They talk about she was an information hub. Well, let me tell you, for the 4 years, we were talking twice a week to the sheikh on the phone. She was never able to be on the phone. The phone calls all came into my office. I was on the phone when I was there. Other people in the office, there were only two others that were authorized to be on the phone. The translator was on the phone, one of his co-defendants. Out of maybe 15 or 20 visits over 4 years, Lynn went on three. So she was the most remote from him, even though she was the most precious to him of the council. But the difference was style, I guess. And nothing happened. I mean, no one's claimed that there was anybody ever got hurt from anything she said. They say they could have, but I doubt that. But in addition to Lynn, if you need any addition, not that her cause isn't enormous, but at stake is the future of sentencing in the United States. We've just been through the guidelines and finally gotten rid of them, and they were barbaric. They tripled the prison population in the United States. They're like the Rockefeller law. Some guy didn't do anything. One night he had coke with a girlfriend or something. 15-year mandatory minimum. Crazy stuff, absolutely crazy. The trial judge has to be the person who determines the sentencing. He's the only person that's there that sees the whole thing, that can understand the whole thing. These guys up on the circuit, they can't. First, if they read the whole record, they could never get the flavor. They don't even see the person. And for them to start trying to review these things, they don't claim there's an error of law in the sentencing. They just claim too lenient. It's too harsh. Then there's a question of effective assistance for unpopular people, for poor people. Lynn could represent people that never had a friend. I mean, there are people that never had a friend. They couldn't remember their parents, you know, if they had any. And they were running with the gang and all the rest from the beginning. Never had a friend. And they love Lynn. She's the best thing that happened in their lives. And she's kept a lot of them out of the penitentiary, and she's kept a lot of them from having sentences that would have been life or long, except for her. But if we don't stand up for the lawyers that are handling these cases, then we're going to send a lot of people, particularly now, to prison for a long time, and we'll pay for it. We'll pay for it not only in the cost of prison, but in what happens to society, because it corrupts society and it manufactures crime. And finally, there's a third reason. But I hope we'll all stand up and never stop until it ends out. And I hope that is in something less than 28 months, minus time served. Thanks to all of you for being here, and we've got an angel that we need to help.
Our next guest knows personally about terrorism and brutality in this country. This country was founded on terrorism, and it has never stood up to apologize or anything. Our next guest personally knows what it's like to be brutalized by the police. And her son, Malcolm Ferguson's young life, was stolen when he was murdered. A gun pointed point blank to his hands in 2000, 5 days after appearing at a demonstration in support of Amadou Diallo. Juanita Young, thank you.
I am really honored to stand here with Lynn Stewart, because we all are Lynn Stewart right now. When I met Lynn Stewart, it was a bad situation. I had just got evicted from my house, and then I was pushed down the steps. But then they charged me with criminal trespassing. When we came to the courtroom, and my friends from October 22nd found out what happened, they said, no, legal aid cannot handle this. The next thing I hear was, Lynn Stewart said to tell you she'll take your case. Lynn Stewart opened the door for me. And from that day to this day, I stand up and I fight and I fight. I say to myself, this woman was like me. She made a life of being a wife to her husband, a mother to her kids, a teacher to the children in our community, a lawyer to people like me. How dare we not stand and fight for Lynn Stewart? I'm telling you, even when she wasn't there and they decided she couldn't practice anymore, her own children stepped in, Jeff Stewart, and said, Juanita, I'm taking your case. That's why I say we all need to get her out of that jail, because we need Lynn Stewart out here to do what she did for me, for many more people that need the support and the work that that woman does. I know, Ralph. I don't know what to say, Ralph.
No, you have said it, and you say it better than anyone else.
Because you know when I'm going to say it? When we have Lynn walking out those jail doors.
Okay, hear, hear.
Because the people, you know, when I was fighting for my son's case, I didn't depend on no politicians. I depended on the people in the community, because I believe the people outnumber the system. And if we stand up and fight and join, they say the people united will never be defeated. I'm saying, come on, let's get Lynn Stewart out of this jail. I say let's free Lynn Stewart. Thank you.
Right on.
It gives me a great honor to announce this next speaker. This next speaker was immersed in the struggle even before his birth. And we all know that the morning of December 4th, 1969, in Chicago, Illinois, is a day of infamy in terms of the history of the black liberation struggle and the struggle against oppression of all people. Chairman Fred Hampton, Jr. is the international chairman of the Prisoners of Conscience Committee, which is a revolutionary organization that is based on the ideology of the Black Panther Party. He is a former political prisoner himself. He is the son of two freedom fighters, the slain Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, Chairman Fred Hampton, and Abakua Njeri. We stand with you, Fred Hampton, Jr., yes, and he embodies. You can kill a revolutionary, but you cannot kill a revolution. You cannot kill the spirit.
Right on, right on, right on. Free Lynn Stewart, free them all. Right on. Revolutionary appreciations, y'all. First and foremost, I'm honored and humbled to be here. Let me preface this. This is no disrespect to none of the lawyers. My general assessment, even about attorneys in this system in general, how they say all doctors have to take a Hippocratic oath. How you say all lawyers have to take a hypocrite oath. I mean, to be able to engage going to these colonial, these capitalist, corrupt courtrooms and not be contaminated. But however, certain forces, this is lawyer in Chicago, I don't want to mention his name because he might get disbarred if I put his name out there. But also Lynn Stewart, an individual who's taking on the unpopular cases. And I stress that because a lot of times we see the people come around when the news cameras come around and the fame and glory, but she's taking a principal stance to take the unpopular cases. I've had the opportunity to speak on a number of panels with Lynn Stewart, radio show interviews, protests, mobilizations, marches, you name it. And she's a force who myself, as well as my family, my organization, have the utmost respect for. I think it's only fitting that this term self-determination is up here. It's something that people don't respect, people's right to self-determination. A lot of people say, well, we're here, we're going to support you. Some little strings attached. Lynn Stewart respects self-determination. It's a struggle within the struggle. True treasure to the high forces like Lynn Stewart that respects this whole situation of self-determination. We have some trying times. A lot of things are going down throughout the world. But the whole question of political prisoners is something that must be taken extremely seriously. As Malcolm X, the assessment about America, he said America itself represents prison. I do recognize, as how Minister UEP Newton has said, that prisons represent a microcosm of the outside community. Never take for granted that those are people being taken care of, that they're alive inside those concentration camps. It is extremely important that we make sure that this government understands that we have not forgotten Lynn Stewart. We have not forgotten the Sekou Odingas, Mumia Abu-Jamals, Rochelle Sekou McGees, and the Move 9, and this goes on and on, our people in general. It serves, take it from somebody who has literally been behind enemy lines. It serves as not only a morale boost to those who are held captive, but also as a security precaution. I'm going to stress that again, so keep those correspondences, those letters, keep, you know what I'm saying, the mobilizations, and we got to always stress that we got to keep that street, what we refer to as that street heat. The power of the people, sending a message to this system, sending a message to the masses that there will not be no class peace as long as our people are still held captive in these modern-day concentration camps. We send a clarion call to everybody, free Lynn Stewart, free them all. Power to the people, free Lynn Stewart, free them all. Right on.
Lynn is an honorary member of our Raging Granny Gaggle, and she has sung with us.
And she's still singing with us.
In old New York City, where justice is blind, there lives a great lawyer who's now in a bind. Her name is Lynn Stewart, and she helps the poor, but she got on the wrong side of America's war. Now George Bush and Ashcroft and Obama too, they're all chicken.
Just what good is freedom if no one is free? And folks go to jail if they dare disagree. Our Lynn is in jail. Stewart was doing what she had to do, protecting her client and civil rights too. She said an attorney must fight to defend. I'd like to think that I would do it again.
Auld Lang Fog night, Auld Lang Fog day.
Now Liz sends a message to you and to me that no one is free until everyone's free. Our whole Bill of Rights now is under the gun. So we'll rage and we'll sing out till justice is done. So we'll rage and we'll sing out till justice is done.
It was a great honor to introduce a speaker who has been in the forefront of the support of Lynn Stewart. I'm talking about Ralph Shulman, the co-producer with Maya Schoen of Taking Aim. Well, you all know who Ralph is, the author of Hidden History of Zionism, Iraq, Kuwait, A History Suppressed, Prisoners of Israel. He's the director of the Prisoners' Rights Organization, the Council on Human Needs. Ralph Shulman.
Brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, I'm extremely happy to be here with you tonight to struggle for Lynn, to be here for Lynn, to speak up for Lynn, to tell truth to power for Lynn. Maya joins me in these sentiments, but that she were here today. I've thought carefully about how to shape my remarks and what to say to you. We're in the way in Taking Aim, and not only there, referring to the struggle of Lynn Stewart in prison and in the courts as the Dreyfus case and the Sacco and Vanzetti cases of our times. And we don't say that lightly or with mere hyperbole, because the persecution and the prosecution of Lynn Stewart represents, as it did with Dreyfus and Sacco and Vanzetti, the act of the criminal state fawning upon or imputing to its victim the crimes for which it is fully responsible and the full author. I'm talking about the category of terror, the so-called war on terror, the treason at the top that represents the events of September 11th, 2001, and no less so in 1993. With the bombing of the World Trade Center at that time. Lynn Stewart was the lawyer for Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, the blind Egyptian cleric, who was charged with organizing and preparing and implementing a plot, the Landmarks plot, to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge, the Manhattan Bridge, the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, the George Washington Bridge, the Statue of Liberty, the United Nations, to assassinate Boutros-Ghali, the then Secretary General, and Senator Alphonse D'Amato. These were the things that were brought to bear by way of charges against the blind Egyptian cleric with his walk-up mosque in New Jersey and in Brooklyn, brothers and sisters. And Lynn Stewart, as his attorney, confronted the following. Now, I had the opportunity, brothers and sisters, in 1993 to write an article, Who Bombed the World Trade Center? Evidence points to the Federal Bureau of Investigation in prevailing winds shortly after the event at that time. This was a false flag operation par excellence. This is not sui generis, brothers and sisters. This is hardly new in our history. What? In 1834, when Polk and the Imperium sought to amputate two-thirds of Mexico, they dressed up U.S. soldiers in Mexican uniforms and shot at soldiers and used it as a casus belli, as Abraham Lincoln protested at the time in the House of Representatives as they proceeded to slaughter away and to amputate that country. By the way, you know, we have these illegal immigrants all over the place now. They're coming to places called Sacramento, San Francisco, San Jose, Santa Barbara, Los Angeles. Throughout American history, throughout the conduct of the affairs of our ruling class, every single imperial adventure has proceeded on the basis of a pretext, a staged operation. Whether it is the bombing of the Maine and Havana Harbor to seize the Philippines and Cuba, whether it is the Gulf of Tonkin, improvised and invented event to create the rationale for the saturation bombing of Indochina, or for that matter, Operation Northwoods, if you recall, in 1962, when the then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Limnitzer, conceived the following plan, signed off, by the way, by every single member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which called for the flying of craft, airplanes, into tall American buildings, assassinating U.S. citizens in Miami and in Washington, D.C., anticipating the blowing up of the rocket-carrying astronaut John Glenn, all of which was to be imputed to the Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro to create the rationale and the pretext and to whip people into a numbed hysteria as they proceeded with a long-prepared operation. Operation Northwoods. It went up to the Kennedy brothers. The response was interesting. The Kennedy brothers, basically Kennedy said, you know, our hand is too obvious in this. We might try putting U.S. soldiers in Cuban uniforms and staging an attack on Guantanamo. Operation Northwoods did not get its imprimatur. The president was dead a year later. This has a long history, integral to the operations of our ruling class. And brothers and sisters, the events of 1993 into which Lynn Stewart found herself defending an innocent man was not merely an act of defense of an innocent man, but by virtue of that defense, a prosecution of our ruling class, of the treason at the top, of the criminals in office, who staged these operations, who have prepared these things, as we documented in my book with Maya, The Hidden History of Zionism since the late 1970s, since Oded Yinon, the Mossad operative conceived of the plan called a strategy for Israel in the 1980s, which called for the fragmentation of each Middle Eastern and Central Asian country in its turn into its ethnic and fragment components. Since at that time, major conferences with the coordination of Netanyahu, who, by the way, you know, Netanyahu had four Social Security cards. Yeah? Benjamin Nitai, John Sullivan, John J. Sullivan, Jr., he was a CIA op. He had four fake names, Netanyahu, long-standing operative of intelligence, who organized conferences in Tel Aviv on the what? The category of terror, which Bush Sr., with Alexander Haig, with members of the Joint Chiefs, what would later be celebrated in the New York Times under the headline, The Sunshine Warrior, reference Paul Wolfowitz, the category of terror conceived already in the late 70s as the ideological rationale with which to replace the Soviet Union in rapid decay. A new justification for imperial reach, a new demonization of others with which to provide the basis for launching new attacks, new assassination operations, and dismantling the formal democratic protections in the United States. Lynn Stewart catapulted into the role of defending the falsely accused, and in so doing, putting on notice and putting at jeopardy the criminals at the top. Why is Lynn Stewart persecuted and prosecuted today, facing three decades in prison for being the lawyer for a man who was falsely accused? Why is the attorney enfolded within the putative crimes of her client when Lynn was appointed by the court to defend Sammy the Bull Gravano, the mafia hitman, who had turned on John Gotti, which she did with excellent dedication and skill. Did it follow from that that Lynn Stewart is a mafia hitman? The absurdity? But look, brothers and sisters, this case, when brought against Lynn Stewart, and even when tried against Lynn Stewart, and even when a sentence was brought in against Lynn Stewart, was a sub judice case before the courts, subject yet to the Second Circuit, subject yet to the Supreme Court of the United States. Lynn Stewart was not a flight risk. Lynn Stewart was committed to vindicating herself, to defending the principles involved, to defending the right to counsel, to defending the right of habeas corpus, to defending rights that date back before Magna Carta to Henry II, brothers and sisters. So what is she doing in jail? What is the basis for Lynn Stewart being in jail right now? Her case is pending. Where are the lawyers? You want to talk truth? Right. 1 year ago, when we were having a demonstration in relation to Lynn Stewart's sentencing and trial, we were to have a rally. Liz Fink and the lawyers said, "Don't do that, Lynn. Keep your mouth shut. Don't provoke the judges." Lynn said, "If I'm not about truth..." What did she say? "If I'm not about truth, I'm about nothing." "Don't go," they said, "on a platform with Ward Churchill. You'll provoke the judges." "If I'm not about truth," said Lynn Stewart, "I'm about nothing." Lynn was scheduled for surgery at that time. The surgery was already scheduled when they remanded her to prison and didn't allow her access to her hospital. Did they allow in her medicines as they said they would? No. Were the medicines they imposed upon her appropriate? They made her almost comatose. When they insisted in the prison on taking Lynn for medical examination within the prison hospital system, how was she handled? Let me tell you, her wrists are shackled. Her ankles are shackled. She's examined. Procedures are performed. Spread-eagled like in the Middle Ages, brothers and sisters. Where are the lawyers? Not one motion to challenge her being kept in prison, put in prison while her case is sub judice. Not motion put forward to challenge the cruel and unusual punishment, the vindictiveness of denying her her medical care at the age of 70 with high blood pressure and diabetes and cancer diagnosis. Where are the lawyers? Where is the National Lawyers Guild? Why was this rally tonight not supposed to have taken place on the advice of the lawyers? I have to tell you this because, brothers and sisters, what did Lynn Stewart say? "If I'm not about truth, I'm about nothing." That's why on July 15th in that courtroom, Lynn Stewart will be pro se. To be an officer of the court, brothers and sisters, does not mean to be an instrument of the prosecution. To be an officer of the court does not mean to acquiesce or cater to or submit to or embrace the language of the courts, the hanging judges thereof. That is not what a defense lawyer in the tradition of Lynn Stewart does. That may be done to her, but that is not what she does, brothers and sisters. How was Sheikh Umar Abdul Rahman brought into the matter of the World Trade Center in 1993 and the Landmarks case? What was the procedure, the methodology? What happened? An FBI operative, a high-level intelligence officer of the Egyptian government named Emad Ali Salem, was sent in by the FBI office in New York wearing a wire into the mosque of Umar Abdul Rahman, where he began to try to attract young men to come to meetings, where he talked about blowing up this and blowing up that, making transcripts of every one of these meetings and conversations, deposited in the offices of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, ferreting out the youngsters who would stick around instead of running a mile, feeding them fantasies of money and power, seeking to entrap, seeking to ensnare, and then what? Organizing a safe house in the name of a particular individual named Guzi Hadass of the Mossad. Organizing to ride a rental van, again, rented to Guzi Hadass. Every single person in the ride a rental van office is a member of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Brothers and sisters, we didn't just document this in Prevailing Winds. It's all over the New York Times. The piece by Ralph Blumenthal in the New York Times describes how when Emad Ali Salem was shortly and unexpectedly detained after 1,000 people were injured and 8 people killed, and the detonation did not fully bring down and collapse towers upon one another. What did Emad Ali Salem say as cited in the New York Times? Well, I was assured by my officers that the explosives would not detonate with that force. What does the New York Times report? He was contradicted by John Ontasef, his superior officer, who said, "Our superiors in Washington are fully cognizant of what had to be done and the arrangements that were made." There is no ambiguity about this event, brothers and sisters. Matara, the Israeli intelligence network, recorded the conversations with an operative named Ann prior to the blowing up of the 1993 World Trade Center, about plans proceeding, specifying what later came to be identified as the events and the activity of Guzi Hadass and Emad Ali Salem. There's no ambiguity about this, brothers and sisters. I wrote to Judge Kotel in 2006, a 10-page letter. I set out all of the evidence. I said the attorneys defending the blind Egyptian cleric had every basis, not merely for fighting for their innocence, but believing in it. You, judge, elected to introduce into that courtroom the specter of Osama bin Laden over and over and over again. Images of the World Trade Center, by the way, the trial taking place after 2001, as you know, over and again. So we suggested to the good judge, you're interested in Osama bin Laden? You want to have an adversary proceeding, bringing into evidence the relevance of Osama bin Laden to the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993 and subsequent events and the authorship thereof? Perhaps you would like to hear the evidence of his full statement made to the Pakistani publication Umat in Karachi, the third largest Urdu language publication in Pakistan. What did he say? It was the sixth such interview. I have, he said, stated repeatedly, and I reiterated here, that I had neither knowledge nor involvement in the events of September 11, 2001. My Islam does not consider it an appreciable act to take the lives of women and children and men, civilian people, not even in time of war. Yes, he said, we have a quarrel, but not with the people of the United States, with those who occupy our countries, who those who debase our culture, to those who seize our resources, to those who assassinate our leaders and our educated people and our professionals, to those who collude with the Zionist state to dispossess our brothers and sisters and seize their land and pursue them in every miserable refugee camp across frontier, we have a problem. But who are they? Osama bin Laden in Umat states they are the people who need billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in funds to pursue yet new wars of aggression. And so they create these events, he said, and they father them upon Osama or Taliban or whomever. Judge Codal, we suggested perhaps if you're interested in the events of September 11th and consider them of such relevance to what occurred 8 years before, such as to incite the fears and the prejudice of the jury, you might allow them to hear, in fact, the evidence pertaining to the role of Osama bin Laden in these events. Remember the basis on which Colin Powell addressed the United Nations to prepare the UN to sanction a U.S. war against Iraq? That we call that study a colonoscopy, if you'll forgive me. What did Colin Powell put forward? Yeah, he said there's a man named al-Zarqawi, a notorious terrorist, an agent of destruction of America, preparing nuclear weapons to use against the United States. What is the evidence for that? Why, he was in a hospital in Baghdad where he had a prosthesis fit to his leg. You see, al-Zarqawi had been one of those who had been wounded and almost killed by a U.S. bomb attack, and he did go to a hospital in Baghdad where he had a prosthesis fit. Later, by the way, al-Zarqawi was killed, and the funeral was held amongst his family and his tribe in Jordan. And Iraqi Shiite Muslim leaders went to France to declare al-Zarqawi was killed. Why did they do that? Well, let me remind you, brothers and sisters, and I'll jump forward from this. Do you recall a young man named Nicholas Byrd, who was supposedly interested in exploring Iraq in the midst of a war? Do you recall that he was taken into custody by the U.S. military and U.S. military intelligence and then released and then disappeared and then he was produced in film? You know how and where? Why, he had been captured by al-Zarqawi, who then on video proceeded to behead him. Do you recall that? The casus belli? They not only brought al-Zarqawi back to life, but they grew him a new leg. Two legs on this video, no prosthesis. Wearing, by the way, boots that are standard U.S. Army issue. That was nice. You see, they make this stuff up as they go along, brothers and sisters. It's like that person for whom all responsibility at a given moment was laid upon for September 11th. Do you remember Muhammad Atta? The same Muhammad Atta, by the way, who was trained at Brooks Air Force Base with crypto security clearance, along with Al-Shehi and Maxwell Air Force Base, and their presumptive hijacking colleague in Monterey Defense Language Institute with their contact address to Pensacola Naval Station, according to Newsweek? Is it the Muhammad Atta of 5'4" and slender build, with no interest in politics or in religion, who aspired to be an engineer? Is it that Muhammad Atta? Is it the Muhammad Atta in Hamburg, Germany, monitored and run by German intelligence as reported by Interior Minister von Bülow? Is it that Muhammad Atta? Is it the Muhammad Atta who was flown all over the world to this conclave and that conclave by the Duisburg Foundation, on the board of which was Henry Kissinger and Nelson Rockefeller? Is it that Muhammad Atta? Is it the Muhammad Atta who was brought to Venice, Florida, to enroll in a flight school and rooming with Charlie Voss, a pilot for Iran-Contra, a coke-running and gun-smuggling pilot of the CIA. Is it that Mohammed Atta? Is it the Mohammed Atta who shows up in a bar, Snookum's bar, drunk out of his mind on Stolichnaya and taking coke? Who says, what makes you think I can't pay this bill? He says, with women on his arm. He says, I work for the U.S. When did they announce the Second Circuit? When did they announce that Lynn Stewart would be remanded to prison as a person who was notorious for enhancing and embracing terrorism? Why, they announced it, the Second Circuit, at the same time that another announcement was made, namely that they were going to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a civilian court in New York for his acts of terror. Do you know what he confessed to, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Not just murdering Julius Caesar and Abraham Lincoln. He confessed to responsibility for the Landmarks bombings and plot, for the 1993 bombing. Oh, well, now we know. So you can release the blind sheikh, and you can embrace Lynn Stewart for having defended an innocent man instead of threatening her with 30 years in prison. Right?
Right on.
Well, let's look at this for 1 second, brothers and sisters. By the way, they also attributed to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed responsibility for blowing up the Nairobi and Dar es Salaam embassies in Egypt, in Kenya and Tanzania, respectively. Except that according to the San Francisco Chronicle, the person who carried those operations, was operating out of Fort Bragg, worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, and had been a special forces commander and officer for many years. Ali Mohammed, written up in full detail as to his relationship to the authorities, that man to whom these events were ascribed. Well, let me tell you, brothers and sisters, about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. On the first anniversary of 9/11, an event took place in Karachi. Hundreds of special forces, FBI, Pakistani police raided a house where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was hiding, they said. Witnessed by journalist after journalist, Pakistani Times, Asia Times, they shot him. As he lay dying in his own blood, he wrote a verse from the Quran, according to the reporters, and a woman from the Federal Bureau of Investigation stepped forward, severed his finger for DNA. All over the newspapers, New York Times corroborated, Asia Times, what have you. 6 months later, March 3rd, 2003, in Rawalpindi, the capital adjacent to Islamabad, where the military and intelligence are centered, a raid takes place on the home of a Pakistani elderly biologist who wasn't at home at the time. The only person there was his 42-year-old retarded son, Abdul Qaddus. We've been there. We've talked to the family. We spend a lot of time with his brothers and sisters. There isn't anybody who represents that any Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was taken into custody at that time. That is the man who they are representing to have in Guantanamo and who they are going to present to us, except that his picture looks absolutely nothing like the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for which there is ample record. Do you remember the confession of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? I no want killed a Jew, blah, blah, blah. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has 2 graduate engineering degrees, brothers and sisters. He's fluent in English, fluent in Urdu, fluent in Baluch, fluent in Arabic, raised in Kuwait as he was, a highly sophisticated man. English is flawless, amply recorded. You understand what we're talking about here, brothers and sisters, from beginning to end? These are contrivances of the state. Why is Lynn Stewart being remanded into custody and held for what they intend to be 30 years? Because these are the acts of a degenerative ruling class in terminal decay, with a system collapsing around it, with imperial adventure after imperial adventure, in deep and abiding crisis. You cannot cater to this state, its apparatus, its rulers, and its hanging judges by making nice, by saying Lynn Stewart didn't mean it, she's a nice old lady. She didn't really understand what she was doing when she was associating herself with this terrible sheikh. She didn't mean to give a press release on his behalf, implementing her obligations as a defense attorney. No, it was the others who made her do it. You can't lawyer like that against a circumstance of this nature, brothers and sisters. You can't fight the criminal state, the crimes for which it is responsible, the demonization of Lynn Stewart in the process, the threats to every attorney that walks in the United States by those means and by that method. Who are these hanging judges? Would you like to know? How about Judge Walker, cousin of George W. Bush and H.W. Bush? Representative of the State Council for Botswana when it was an apartheid. Bantustan. How about Judge Walker, who's beaten the drums for Lynn Stewart to do 30 years? On October 10, 2006, Judge Walker was driving his SUV in Connecticut. What did he do? He ran down a traffic cop and killed him. Was he detained? No. Did the police do a blood test to see how much alcohol he had in his system? No. Was there a charge of vehicular manslaughter, involuntary homicide? No. What about Judge Sachs? Why, he's the partner of Judge Mukasey, Michael Mukasey. Who's Michael Mukasey? He sentenced the blank cleric to life plus 100 years. When he was nominated for Attorney General, Michael Mukasey stated and wrote in an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, we will not and cannot have a juridical system and a political system that allows trials for those accused of crimes against the state or terror. We need, he said, a parallel adjudicatory system in which people will be remanded into custody and held there indefinitely, exactly as when you are dealing with mental deficients, quote unquote, Wall Street Journal. Michael Mukasey. Did Judge Sachs recuse himself? 22 years a law partner with these white shoe firms that represent DuPont, the American Stock Exchange, General Motors, every major banking, corporate, stockbrokership, military, and corporate firm in the U.S., all these judges. What about Robert Wesley? They're all members of these white shoe law firms. I've got chapter and verse here. We've done it on Taking Aim. I'm going to wrap it up. Judge Wesley, amongst those beating the drums for Lynn Stewart to have an enhanced sentence because she perjured herself. She perjured herself? She issued a press release for the sheikh as part of her responsibilities and she perjured herself? What did Robert Wesley say when a black prisoner was attacked by a prison guard and he fought back and the guard died? He said judicially, that's why we need to have the death penalty, because we have to deal with animals like this. These are the hanging judges of the Second Circuit, brothers and sisters. Do not, and we will not, cater not just to their prejudice, not just to their ruling class instincts, but to their bad law. There isn't a single piece of law, no court case referral in that Second Circuit verdict. No. As Judge Pooler noted, their comments are worth no more than a letter to the editor. They're an indulgence in prejudice. They're an incitement to what? To burying Lynn Stewart alive. You cannot, and we cannot, and will not fight this case by catering to these people, by suborning ourselves to their plots and plans. We will resist them. We will expose them. We will beat them in the streets. We will make the political price too high. We will talk about the criminal acts of the state. We will talk about Lynn Stewart as the Sacklin, Vanzetti, and Dreyfus case of our time, because she is, and she has to be defended that way.
We want everybody at Foley Square on Wednesday, Tom Paine Park, 5:30. We're going to march, and we're going to go down to Park Row.
Yes, about 3 blocks.
And when we get down there, we're going to make incredible noise. We're going to rattle the windows.
And it will help Lynn, because she said to me, sitting in those 4 walls, she gets lifted up every time she hears a demonstration down behind the courthouse. And we are going to give them the demonstration of demonstrations. We are going to try to do a Joshua down there and bring those walls down.
And the next day, to pack the courtroom, we're gathering in front of the federal building. That's Thursday, July 15th, starting at 11 o'clock, and for the resentencing at 2 p.m.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen.